The presidents of ASU and U of A each got six-figure merit bonuses this morning from the Arizona Board of Regents. And the regents tried to head off any criticism of the dollar amount.
This was kind of an opportunity for the regents to just kind of reiterate why they have these bonuses, which is they're tied to specific goals.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, Valley Catholics reflect on the Pope's visit to the U.S., why prescribed burns could help prevent massive wildfires,
the Navajo Nation's new poet laureate,
and illustrating what happens in court.
The job revolves around something terrible having happened. You try to detach, and I'm the only one having a good time over here drawing pictures.
Plus, bringing Bossa Nova into the classroom, and we jump to the left and step to the right.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Valley weather for tonight. Look for clear skies and lows around 80. And then for this weekend, we've settled into a pattern. Sunny skies, dry conditions, and highs around 102. Currently with relative humidity at 19%, it's sunny and 101 degrees. In Valley traffic, an accident 101 westbound at 35th Avenue. Also watch out for a collision blocking the shoulder, I-17 southbound at Bethany Home.
John Boehner has announced he will step down from his post as the Speaker of the House after 5 years. The 13-term Republican from Ohio says he'll resign at the end of October. He says he's leaving the post due to conservative members of the House who want to defund Planned Parenthood, leading to a possible government shutdown. But Arizona Republican Congressman David Schweikert says that's not the reason.
That's absolutely a crazy excuse, and the evidence doesn't point anywhere near there. We are always turbulent. It's the House of Representatives. If it's not cantankerous, there's something wrong. It is its nature.
Schweikert says he doesn't know who might replace Boehner. The Arizona Board of Regents this morning approved merit bonuses for the presidents of the state's three public universities. ASU's Michael Crow and U of A's Ann Weaver Hart each received six-figure bonuses. Those were among the items on the board's two-day agenda in Flagstaff. Ann Ryman is a senior reporter at the Arizona Republic and covers higher education. And were the bonuses a surprise?
No, it wasn't. They set up incentives about 3 years ago. So the first year, it was a much smaller incentive. And the incentives that they approved today were really based on, 3 years worth of work. So if they met the target that the board set for them, they would get the incentive. So no, it wasn't a surprise.
And it sounded like in some of their comments after the vote, the regents were sort of trying to fend off criticism of some of the dollar amounts that the presidents were getting, saying that you need this kind of thing to recruit and retain talent.
Yes, these performance incentives and bonuses can always be controversial. They've been in the business world for many years, and they can be controversial there, too. So I think this was kind of an opportunity for the regents to just kind of reiterate why they have these bonuses, which is they're tied to specific goals. One of them is student retention, for example, which is very important. You want to not only get students in the door, but you want to get them to be able to stay and graduate. And so I think the regents really wanted to just reiterate why they have these incentives and that they are tied to certain things.
The regents also approved a new plan for the upcoming year, a legislative agenda, and also looks like they're going to be asking state lawmakers for some more money.
Yes, they are going to be asking state lawmakers. They received about $99 million in cuts, and they are going to go back to state lawmakers and ask them to restore some of that money, about $24 million for this fiscal year.
Is that a realistic strategy, do you think?
I guess we'll see. It'll be interesting to see kind of what the reception is. The regents' thinking is that the projections for finances are coming in a lot better than what we thought they would be. And so if there is additional money, perhaps the legislature would be inclined to pass some of that along to them.
The regents were also scheduled to take up the university budgets. Did those three spending plans get approved by the regents?
Yes, they have to present a plan to the legislature, and I believe it is in October, and so that was approved, yes.
Was there anything that came out of this two-day meeting in Flagstaff that gives you a sense of sort of the direction that the regents are looking to go or the direction that universities are looking to go in the near future?
Yes, I think they're definitely going to be emphasizing the in-state students and getting the state to they want to get to a point where the state would provide 50% of the funding for them. And so right now it's not close to that at all. And so I think that's really going to be what their message to the legislature is going to be in the next year. They also want to draw additional in-state students to the universities. The Regents recently had a study with fewer than half of the graduates of Arizona High School are actually eligible and actually qualify and meet the requirements to attend the state universities. So I'm expecting that we're going to see a lot of emphasis and a lot of focus on how do you get more of those students to qualify.
Ann Ryman is a senior reporter for the Arizona Republic. She covers higher education. Ann, thanks.
Thank you.
Even though the Pope's visit to the U.S. took place on the other side of the country, Catholics in Arizona were paying close attention during this historic week. KJZZ's Phil Latzman got a feel for how the papal visit sounded here in the desert.
The Pope's speech to Congress was on too early for watch parties in the valley, but at Brophy College Preparatory, a Jesuit boys-only high school in Phoenix, students were invited to view a replay of the address during lunchtime, and the room was filled.
Knowing that so many of you are also descendants of immigrants.
Sam Broyles was listening closely. He believes Francis is changing what it means to be a Catholic.
Catholicism has become seen as a group of people who exclude others and who are very strict in their laws and rules. And he's making it something that's about helping other people and including those, even if they don't share your exact same values and beliefs.
Fellow students Connor Nagaki and Joe Hart were impressed by the Pope's courage.
I think I'll just remember the way he talked with such confidence in a language he doesn't know, to people he doesn't know, of such high power in a country that's very powerful.
He even pointed out that we're a great country, that we do a lot of things right, but we have a lot of wrongs by sacrificing some of the rights.
Paul Fisco of the school's Office of Faith and Justice helped to arrange the student gathering. He calls it the Francis effect.
People are intrigued by this man, and so they're very willing to listen to him because they've heard from adults and maybe even other students that Francis is the kind of a guy who a lot of people are pointing to as a model of goodwill, a model of some progressive thinking about the world.
Fisco said the Pope's visit was the perfect teachable moment for his students, especially when it comes to one issue of particular concern to Arizona.
For the Pope to speak to us in terms of the immigrant should not be seen as criminal, should not be greeted as someone to be feared, but as neighbor, as human person, that speaks and resonates, I think, with people in Arizona.
The Phoenix Diocese estimates there are more than 1.1 million Catholics in the state, making them the largest single religious group in Arizona. At Scottsdale's Our Lady of Perpetual Help Catholic Church, parishioners Jody Cromer and Cynthia Spottleston attended morning mass and were similarly impressed with Francis's ability to reach a new audience.
Oh, I think he's a great inspiration for all Christians, every faith. He's just a blessing to be here on American soil.
He's more real, yes. He's more with today's lifestyle, I think.
Church volunteer Jenny Carney says he's just what Catholicism needs.
I love this Pope. I think this Pope stands for so much more of what is going on in the world right now, and it makes me proud to be a Catholic.
Proud enough to travel all the way to Washington this week was Paul Mulligan, CEO of Catholic Charities Arizona. He says the Pope's special devotion to the poor helps his cause.
His message about the poor, the vulnerable, the marginalized, brought that with him from Buenos Aires, and he really lived that among his own people. And yeah, coming from Catholic Charities world myself, his message is just what we all need to hear.
Phoenix-based Democratic Congressman Ruben Gallego was in the Capitol crowd listening to the Pope's historic speech.
Obviously his conversation on immigration reform and his emphasis on that and treating the stranger in our land, humanely was very strong. But the most important thing that I think that everyone's going to take away from this or people are going to remember, and the most powerful I think it was for us in Congress, was when he started talking about the golden rule.
Do unto others as you will have them do unto you.
Arizona's Republican Governor Doug Ducey was also among the state's contingent in Washington this week. A lifelong Catholic, Ducey released a statement saying the Pope's message of hope and compassion is, quote, one the world should hear and take heart. Phil Latzman, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
DPS Director Frank Milstead announced 1 week ago that law enforcement officers had arrested Leslie Allen Merritt Jr. for some of the I-10 shootings. He's since been charged with 16 counts, including aggravated assault and unlawful discharge of a weapon. And until earlier this week, ADOT message boards were prominently displaying a tip line number for residents to call if they had any more information related to the shootings. But how much can law enforcement count on the public to help and provide accurate and helpful tips? Paul Penzone is a retired Phoenix police sergeant who also was involved with the city's Silent Witness program. Paul, what expectations can law enforcement have in working with the public on Silent Witness or a tip line?
One thing stands true, and that is the community knows far more about crime than law enforcement does. And what I mean by that is law enforcement understands how to investigate crime. But a lot of the information related to who's responsible is on the street. And the only way that it will go from the streets to law enforcement is if the community decides to get engaged. So Silent Witness was a program designed to create that outlet but still protect people, because there's always a concern for your safety if you're going to share information related to somebody who's up to, you know, bad behaviors. So we have to provide a resource and an outlet to protect people, but also empower them to be a part of the solution.
Paul, in recent days, ADOT's been working with law enforcement, including DPS, with overhead signs and having a tip line and that sort of thing. In general, what are some of the, I'm going to use the word challenge again, what are some of the challenges that go into knowing when there's a tip line like this? Does law enforcement have to go into this knowing that there's going to be a lot of stuff to sift through, a lot of tips to work through, and knowing that a huge, huge majority are just really not going to lead anywhere?
I think it's the old adage, watch what you wish for, you just may get it. You know, law enforcement goes out and says, if you have any information you think has value, please call us. Let us determine if it's good or bad. Don't assume that it doesn't have value on our behalf. So if you're going to make that request, you have to staff properly, you have to train properly, and to make sure that whether it's 100,000 tips or 100 tips, that you have the capability to go through those and give them the time, the effort necessary to deem if they have value in an investigation. Because the smallest piece that you may overlook or take for granted could have been the one piece in the puzzle that you know gives you a clear picture to help solve that case.
Do you think it's worth a shot to do that for law enforcement, as long as they're committed to knowing that this is not going to be an easy way to get through it? Because some of the information, again, is going to be sort of created from whole cloth.
I think it comes down to balancing your resources. You know, you don't want to overstaff an area at the detriment to another. So the investigators, those that are out there doing surveillance, those that are out there doing operations that contribute to building an entire case, they can't be depleted for the benefit of tips. At the same time, you can find ways to staff and supplement a tip line, you know, with light duty officers, sometimes even utilizing civilians who have a background check and are deemed to be trustworthy and trained well enough to understand how to process that. So you can utilize resources that don't take away from your operations to staff these lines to make sure that you are taking in all tips and that you're processing them all.
Paul, is there any reason to think it would be harder today than it would have been perhaps 15 or 20 years ago to get the public's help for different cases?
I think there's a pro and a con. The pro is with technology, with our ability to communicate to a broader audience, it enhances our ability to utilize a program like Silent Witness, and whether it's social network or advertising or marketing. At the same time, you know, we're saturated with stimulus, whether it's, you know, audio or visual. There's so much going on that oftentimes the things that are most important can get lost in the mix. So the challenge comes in, how do we make sure that if the community doesn't feel that you're crying wolf, that when we call out to you, it's important you need to pay attention and set other things aside so that we can collaborate on this need at this time.
Retired Phoenix Police Sergeant Paul Penzone. He was also heavily involved with the city's Silent Witness program.
Still to come on the show, you work hard for the money, but have you ever asked yourself why?
What I should be doing, what I've been put on this earth to do, what I feel I need to do to become a better person.
We search for the elusive work-life balance just ahead. It's the show.
And good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. We're bringing you more of our community mixed with national stories and international news on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays at 2. Valley weather for tonight. Look for clear skies. Overnight lows around 80 degrees. It'll be a sunny, dry weekend with a high of 102 on Saturday and then warming to 103 on Sunday. Currently, relative humidity is at 19%. We have blue skies and 101 degrees. Meanwhile, in Valley traffic, an accident on I-17 southbound at Bethany Home is blocking the shoulder. There's also an accident on the 101 westbound at 35th Avenue. It's 219.
KJZZ is supported by Subaru Superstore of Chandler, a local family-owned and operated dealership, presenting the new 2016 Subaru Legacy, the 36 mpg midsize sedan redefined. Ready now for test drives. Shop Subaru.com.
The Navajo Nation recently appointed its second poet laureate. Laura Tohi is an English professor at ASU and has some specific goals for her two-year term.
Well, this position is a new position to the Navajo Nation, so lots of people don't know what a poet laureate is. And during my tenure in this position, I hope to make more aware to the Navajo people what a poet laureate is, because we have in our culture, the oral tradition, which is actually how I got started in my writing. So what I'd like to do during this time is to bring greater awareness of what a poet laureate is, and also to try to work towards getting Navajo writers' works into the schools on the Navajo reservation. Presently, that is not happening. Many of my own people do not know who our writers are.
I'm curious about something you said about how the oral tradition got you started in writing. And it seems like for a lot of cultures that the oral tradition goes back much, much further than the written language necessarily does. How do those two relate to each other, do you think, in Navajo tradition?
Well, in Navajo tradition, you know, that's how we preserved our culture, our language, our philosophy, our stories. We pass it on through word of mouth to the younger generation. I see that's somewhat not happening as much.
The issue of language and fluency, as you know, has become a big issue among Navajos over the past several months. It became a really big issue during the most recent presidential election, and it seems as though there's some discussion going on among members of the Navajo Nation about what is language and how much of the traditional Navajo language does one need to know. Where do you fall on that?
Well, I grew up as Navajo being my first language, and then I learned English. The controversy that has occurred that you're referring to is the language requirement is to know Navajo language fluently is no longer required of our presidential candidates. There is a grassroots people, which I attended one of the first meetings, in which we discussed how we can save our language for the next generation. And what we really decided is that the language needs to be taught in the home and in the community, and not necessarily rely on schools to provide that to the students, because oftentimes what happens is the children might speak the Navajo language at school, but when they get home or in the community, they do not speak the language. So I think that it's very important that we save our language. Part of that language tells us who we are. It preserves our identity as Diné people, as Navajo people. It preserves our history, our philosophy, and our view of the world. And I think that's very important to save those things for the next generation.
Can you read one of your poems for us?
Yes. This one is called Water Spirit. I wrote this for my paternal grandmother, who used to tell us these stories about water. And this is something that she told us, and it's written in Navajo language as well, but I'll read the English version. water spirit for Glen Tohi. When you come to a river or lake or pond, one you haven't met, you must meet its spirit. Place your hand into its belly, feel the energy, stroke its power, caress the life source. Let it run through your hands, say a prayer. You must meet its spirit, and it will never steal you, was what she told us as children.
How do you decide in which language you're going to write your poems?
It tells me. The poem will tell me if I need to use a Navajo word or if I use English, I have to do that. Or sometimes I might have a Navajo word and then I have to translate that because I know many of my writers do not, or many of my readers do not speak Navajo language. So I rely on the poem to let me know.
How does it come to you?
Well, I think a lot of times is I have to open myself to receive what I need to write a poem. I think as a writer, as an artist, I feel like there is something that is giving me what I need to have, and I have to have faith in that.
Laura Tohi is an English professor in ASU's College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. She's also the recently appointed Navajo Nation Poet Laureate. Laura, thank you.
Thank you.
Arizona's wildfire season was relatively light with limited destruction and damage, but Northern California and Washington State in particular have been hit hard. Eastern Washington alone has had nearly 1 million acres burned. Northern Arizona University professor Pete Foulet of the School of Forestry co-authored a paper called Reform Forest Fire Management. It argues that using more prescribed or managed burns could help limit catastrophic wildfires in the future.
These kinds of fires, when you have prescribed burning or when you manage a wildfire in a way that is consistent with the natural ecology of fire in that ecosystem, allows fire to start to resume its natural role once again. So we have consumption of fuels, we have thinning of some of the small trees that create fuel ladders and allow fires to spread up into the canopy. And over large landscapes, when fire is back on the ground, there is good evidence that it once again begins to form a mosaic of recently burned areas. That means that when conditions become more severe, when you get drier conditions and wildfires start that we need to control, it gives us places where the fire will run into previously burned areas, it'll run out of fuel, it'll create safe places for suppression forces to do their work. So there's a multitude of benefits from having fire back on the landscape.
And given that logic then, why don't we see more of them?
It can be difficult to carry out. There's several reasons. So one is that agencies that manage natural resources, and particularly the Forest Service, which is the agency really at the forefront of the firefighting efforts, but others are very important too, like the National Park Service and others, they don't have enough resources. And currently, a lot of resources are diverted to the necessary goal of fire suppression. But what our group was calling for in this particular article that came out a week ago was to try to consider the bigger picture, try to not take funding away from research on the effectiveness of fire and other restoration tools like thinning of small trees, and to not take resources away from getting those projects put into place. So what happens is that we end up chasing each emergency, and we have to do that, but we don't necessarily have to do it by taking away resources from the very programs that would help reduce the scope of those emergencies in the first place.
Can prescribed burns, can managed burns be as small or as large as the people in charge would like it to be as long as it's planned out, or does it have to be sort of in a limited scope?
The scale can really be, the potential for the scale is to be pretty large, both the scale in space, like in terms of how big individual fires can grow, and also in time, in terms of frequency. And we have some good examples. When it comes to the frequency of fire use in the U.S., the place that really leads, the region of the country that really leads, as an example, is the Southeast, where a substantial amount of prescribed burning is done quite frequently, and both society and sort of the legal and policy framework have adjusted to make that possible. In terms of the scope of size of fires, We have some great examples in the Southwest in places like the Gila Wilderness and the Gila National Forest, Grand Canyon National Park. Many units of the Forest Service, such as the Tucson District or the Kaibab National Forest, where you almost have a mosaic of fires that begins to approach what the natural fire regime looked like in the past. And some places on tribal lands, including the Hualapai Tribe in northwestern Arizona and the San Carlos Apache Tribe in east central Arizona.
Professor Pete Foulet of NAU, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
It's astounding. Time is fleeting.
So true, and in fact, tomorrow marks 40 years since the U.S. release of the Rocky Horror Picture Show. The science fiction satire about a naive couple that stumbles upon the castle of Dr. Frankenfurter, a mad scientist with unique taste.
I think perhaps you better both come inside.
Full of music and mayhem, the movie has attracted a cult following over the decades, and those fans have done the time warp again and again.
If you don't want to dance and sing along alone, you go to a shadow cast. That's a late-night screening of the film, usually with live theatrics and toilet paper throwing.
You could call it a double feature picture and parody show.
These parties have been happening all over the country for decades. In Phoenix, a group called Frankie's Fishnets holds a shadow cast every month to keep the Rocky Horror spirit alive.
Hot patootie.
I pledge allegiance to the lips of the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
My name is Amanda Proctor, and I am the stage director of Frankie's Fishnets.
The cast dresses up as Rocky Horror characters and acts out the scenes on stage in front of the screen. Proctor dons the curly black wig and high heels of Dr. Frankenfurter.
How do you do, I?
See, you've met my faithful hand in hand.
Longtime Rocky Horror fan Dawn Gilpin was at the last shadow cast, but it wasn't her first time seeing Rocky Horror on the big screen. That was when she was 12.
I convinced my mom to take me to the midnight show. I guess props to her for not making us leave a few minutes in when we watched the whole movie. It was very educational for me at 12. I think it probably explains a lot.
Fans like Gilpin come to sing the songs they know by heart and also ad-lib.
And of course, to throw things at the screen, as is the tradition, and generally cause a ruckus.
Clearly, Rocky Horror is a cult classic, and Proctor says she thinks shadow casts are one of the things that have kept it going for so many years, and it's what allows Frankie's Fishnets to keep going too.
We interact with the audience, so they feel like they're in the movie now. They don't just feel like they're watching the movie, they feel like they're part of it, you know?
You don't have to just dream of being at the next show. You can be at the next show tomorrow night at the Arizona Event Center.
Now, should we do it again?
It's just a jump to the left.
Coming up on the show, singing in class isn't just for choir students.
I love music. It can help students to remember vocabulary and also things about the culture.
Well, be sure to get a song stuck in your head. Blame it on the bossa nova. That's the show. Good afternoon. You're listening to the show on KJZZ. He's Steve. I'm Mark. The show is a stream of curated stories from Phoenix, our region, and around the country. With the help of reporters and producers around the region and across the globe, we'll keep you up to date and entertained.
Valley weather for the rest of this afternoon. We will stay sunny and we will stay hot, and that'll go that way into the weekend as well, with high temperatures about 5 to 6 degrees above normal. We're expecting highs around 102 or 103. Currently under a blue sky, it is 101 degrees at KJZZ. Meanwhile, in Valley traffic, an accident on the 101 westbound at 35th Avenue, another I-17 southbound at Bethany Home, that's blocking the shoulder. Also seeing some heavy slowing on the 202 westbound, that's right around 32nd Street. It's 2:33.
KJZZ is supported by SRP, providing over 150 education grants last year to schools in our community, creating a foundation for future scientists, engineers, technicians, and tradespeople. More at srp4edu.com.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. President Obama and China's President Xi Jinping have agreed the two countries will not engage in economic cyber espionage. The two leaders met at the White House today. Obama says he raised what he called serious concerns about Chinese cyber spying and told his Chinese counterpart it has to stop.
We've agreed that neither the U.S. or the Chinese government will conduct or knowingly support cyber-enabled theft of intellectual property, including trade secrets or other confidential business information for commercial advantage. In addition, we'll work together and with other nations to promote international rules of the road for appropriate conduct in cyberspace.
Obama says the U.S. and China are also agreeing to cooperate more in combating climate change. The president is calling House Speaker John Boehner a good man and a patriot who has always kept his word. His remarks were in reaction to Boehner's decision today to resign at the end of next month, ending nearly 5 years in the speaker's post. Lawmakers on the Republican side say Boehner's move likely paves the way for passage of a stopgap spending bill to keep the government operating past the end of the month. A huge crowd is greeting Pope Francis in New York's Central Park at this hour. Earlier today, the pontiff went to the 9/11 Museum at Ground Zero, where he offered prayers for peace.
God of peace, bring your peace to our violent world. Peace in the hearts of all men and women, and peace among the nations of the earth.
Francis has also celebrated Mass at Madison Square Garden today and visited this afternoon with students at a Catholic school in Harlem. On Wall Street today, stock prices were mixed, with the Dow closing up 113 points, but the S&P 500 index was down a fraction. This is NPR News.
Good afternoon in KJZZ News at 2:36. The director of the Department of Child Safety says backlogged cases outnumber agency workers by a roughly 15-to-1 gap, which he says cannot be bridged. The Arizona Capital Times reports DCS Director Greg McKay told lawmakers yesterday 52,000 new cases each year make the backlog impossible to eradicate using the agency's current capacity. The agency was created in May of 2014. It set a goal of reducing those cases to 1,000 by the end of the fiscal year 2015. The backlog has risen by nearly 2,000 cases since June of 2014.
Court testimony today revealed the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office spent $250,000 on an informant's secret investigation that went nowhere. KJZZ's Jude Jaffe Block filed this report from the federal courthouse, where contempt of court proceedings are underway.
Chief Deputy Jerry Sheridan answered questions about the sheriff's confidential informant, Dennis Montgomery, who calls himself a CIA-NSA whistleblower. Sheridan said the sheriff only hired Montgomery to investigate wrongdoing by the federal government. Sheridan said only after the sheriff's office had doubts and threatened to stop working with Montgomery did he produce information on his own about Judge Snow as a way to entice the sheriff to keep paying him. Sheridan said that ploy didn't work, and he says he ordered his staff not to investigate the judge. But plaintiffs presented evidence that Montgomery turned in materials about Snow colluding with the Department of Justice as early as November 2013. And the sheriff's office did keep paying him long after that. Jude Jaffe Block, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Most people involved in Sheriff Joe Arpaio's current contempt of court hearing before Judge Murray Snow are intensely invested in the outcome and aren't exactly having fun. But courtroom artist Maggie Keene, who's attended a number of days as the hearing is stretched out over months, is able to provide a very different impression of the proceedings. Maggie, you've done many drawings of the sheriff. Have you heard what he thinks of your work?
He wanted to know why I make him look like the devil all the time. He's very concerned about his image. And there are some times, you know, like that Tom Brady sketch didn't turn out so good. because you're under a lot of pressure and you have a, you know, a time constraint. You need to get as much in as you can, and sometimes he's far away. And frankly, he's been crouching lower and lower and lower. He's all the way across the room from me, and I really have to crane my neck to see him. And he's got a computer monitor right in front of his face, and sometimes all I can see is from his glasses up.
How many drawings will you do in a typical day? How many do you aim to do, and how long does it take you to get one done?
The Arpaio trial is a 9-to-5 job. It's 9-to-5, mm-hmm. and we get a lunch break, and we get 2 afternoon breaks, so it's luxury for me because I can take my time and I can do a really good job. And I know that at noon I'll have a couple of sketches to take down there for them to shoot. The broadcast isn't until 4 or 5 at night. So I try to do an overall sketch. I try to get the main character. I try to get the judge. I try to get whoever's on the witness stand. It'll take me maybe 20 minutes to an hour to get a sketch of one person, or a little bit longer to sketch of an entire room.
Whether Arpaio comes out victorious or he doesn't, is there a scene that you would look for at the climax of a major court hearing like this?
There was a climax back in April when he was really put, he was really, that judge means business.
When Judge Snow was questioning him.
He means business, and that caught Arpaio completely off guard. That was, to me, was a climax. I was just riveted because he went from bragging and kind of self-aggrandizing comments and being very proud and very smug to literally shrinking down in his seat, and you could barely hear his voice when he answered the judge's questions. There were barely whispers. You could tell. It was very dramatic.
Did you feel like you were able to capture that in your art?
I hope I did, yeah. I saw him just crouching, and you know, he didn't really look like the devil that day. He was very humbled, and he didn't like being there.
If this could be a regular job for you, would that be okay? Or would you feel like, I doing it every once in a while is okay?
I really need to paint. I was a billboard painter in the 80s. And it was very good practice for me because they were done in oils with brushes.
Okay.
And I got a lot of really good practice. But, you know, by the end of the day, after a couple of years of painting billboards, I didn't want to paint anything. But I enjoy doing my own paintings, and I'd like to have more time to do that, and which is really nice because of how flexible this job is. But I really like to go and sketch. In fact, I think I'm the only one in the courtroom that's having a good time because the job revolves around something terrible having happened. You know, someone really messed up their life somehow, or somebody murdered someone, or like the Jared Loughner case was really hard to get through it sometimes, but you try to detach, and I'm the only one having a good time over here drawing pictures.
Maggie Keene is an artist. We've been talking with her about being a courtroom artist. Maggie, thanks for coming in.
Oh, thank you.
The 9-to-5 grind, which typically is a lot longer than 9-to-5, can become a drag, a draining routine that people put up with because they need to support their family. But what if you can provide that support while making your own hours and doing something that's much more rewarding spiritually and potentially financially? Amber Anderson took that step when she left the corporate world a couple of years ago and started a business called Kaysen. She said everything changed when her child, named Kaysen, was born prematurely.
I think I was going in that direction where I knew that I wanted to make my life have more value than it did. But at the time when I had my son, and it was about time for my maternity leave to end, he still couldn't hear and he couldn't see. And he was, of course, 2 months early, so he was just to the point where a newborn should be. His weight was still low. We were still trying to figure out if he had any complications from the prematurity. We weren't ready. My husband and I, he is... took off 4.5 months, so we were together with Kaysen, our son, and a family, and we decided that at that point we weren't going to make those sacrifices anymore.
Did you have colleagues that you would talk with about this over lunch or something and say, but wouldn't it be great if we could do something better? But whoops, oh my gosh, I'm getting beeped right now. I can't even think about that.
Right?
Was
yeah,
that kind of
absolutely.
Lesson?
Absolutely. So I think there's lots of people that have those conversations, especially in a creative environment like technology. I mean, you're in the midst of creating something people have never seen and never done before. And lots of times you would think, you know, I could do this if I didn't have so many restrictions or confinements. And then you go back to work.
What did it feel like, and how did you decide this was really going to be the day to do it?
So first off, I'm pretty, I don't want to say aggressive, but I've always had a passion. I was a D1 athlete. I played softball at ASU. Okay. So being able to come up with challenges was never the issue for me. Mm. I think what was really important was seeing that we didn't want to leave Kaysen and knowing there was no other alternative. So it became the only option, which makes you move into a direction that you maybe wouldn't have gone into, but then you don't see another way out, so you make the best of it.
But there are also people at the same time who would say, we need to find as much time to spend with our child, but if I stay in a corporate job, then I've got all these other little benefits. Now, of course, I'll never see my child because I'll be at work all the time, but right. I'll have these other things. I mean, was there a divide there as well for you?
Yeah. So lucky for us, we had been planning for a while. So my husband and I were together for 12 years before we got had Kaysen. We dated for 9. And part of that, the last 3, was really saying before we have a child, we want to make sure we don't have to make those tough choices. So lucky for us, we had done some due diligence in the beginning to say, you know, we should save some money, maybe not spend it all here, work really hard, hustle or whatever we need to do, and those rewards will pay off later. I didn't think they would pay off in this way, but they have.
Do you find that there's more balance now for you, personal, family, and business? Because again, we sort of joked about the corporate life. There's no balance.
There. Right. There's no balance. And I actually would say that I don't think life in this century is about balance. It's about the journey. So what we look to do is to incorporate our life and our work and enjoy all of that. So it's not like my clock starts at 8 and it ends at 6 because that's what was defined for me. It's whatever our family needs and whatever our life purpose is. Sometimes I'll work at 2 in the morning because that's what I want to do and that's what I enjoy doing. Mm-hmm. But my husband and I have our son full time, so we don't have daycare or nanny still. And so for us, it's all about it. It's continuous.
Do you ever, even for a second, say, boy, I think maybe I stayed in corporate life too long because of how great this has turned out to be?
I do. My husband's really great sometimes at being, it's a pair, I got to be honest, right? So I have a great partner and he helps me through that. But I think one of the things he does is, you know, just saying everything that we've done up to this point was to get us to this destination. Mm-hmm. And it's true. There's lots of decisions that I'm like, why did I do that? But the reality is it was part of my journey, and I am where I am because I made that decision, and I would not change it. It's the butterfly effect.
Amber Anderson is co-owner of Kaysen, and she's been telling us about her dream job. Amber, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Pleasure's all mine.
Family considerations are one reason someone might leave a steady job for one that could be a dream one, but why else? Mike Rose tries to answer questions like that. He's a professor in the UCLA Graduate School of Education and Information Studies.
Well, of course, you know, it's going to be different for different people. But I think one thing that's really important just to start with is the fact that a lot depends on the nature of the workplace itself. And then a second thing that's really important, I think, is why is the person working, whatever the job is? That, too, can lead someone to, you know, stick with a job that's not that great. I think what happens is something like this. There's a kind of calculus or something that goes on in our heads. And these things I mentioned about the quality of the workplace and whatever pressures are on a person to continue to work, do those things finally slip out of balance with a really strong desire that somebody might have to be doing something else?
So it sounds like there's kind of a balance between the, I guess, idealistic thought process of, I don't really like this job that much, I'd really love to be doing X, versus, well, this job gives me health insurance and I get a steady paycheck and helps me, you know, provide for my family, that sort of thing. That those two processes have to sort of stay in balance for people to really make a rational decision.
I think so, and I think as we were saying, that what happens when, you know, when we do read these stories all the time of people who give up what seem like just really secure and jobs, benefits and whatnot, to strike out and do something that is quite different, that balance starts to tip, and it tips in favor of fulfilling this kind of deep longing, this sense that I'm not doing
what I should be doing, what I've been put on this earth to do, what I feel I need to do to become a better person.
Is there a difference between leaving a steady job to do something that you just really, really want to do, you maybe have always wanted to do it, versus something that maybe you feel you have a duty to do or an obligation to do?
Yeah, so that's another dimension of what we're talking about, right? This whole question of values becomes very important. Values also can keep someone in a job that they don't like, but that does something really important for them, enables them to support a family. But we also, we hear these stories about people who, a guy I know who left a lucrative law firm because he just felt a strong obligation to work for the homeless. So bringing his legal skills, keeping those, but going into a very different kind of work, obviously had a huge cut in pay. So sometimes people's values, their religious commitments or whatnot, also become a very powerful draw to leave one kind of work and go to another.
For people who make this change, how do they define whether or not it was a good idea or not?
You know, here I'm giving you a guess rather than based on some kind of hard research that I could quote, but just my guess based on my own experience and my own work would be that there's got to be more to it than just a sense of happiness. I think there is a sense of fulfillment. We mentioned values. There may be a sense that some kind of core value is being honored. I think that there must be multiple needs and values that get addressed, and that's how someone knows that they've made the right choice.
Mike Rose is a professor in the UCLA Graduate School of Education and Information Studies. He's also an author. His books include The Mind at Work, Valuing the Intelligence of the American Worker. Good afternoon. It's the show. I'm Mark. He's Steve. In Valley traffic, 101 westbound, an accident at 35th Avenue. 101 southbound in the East Valley, an accident on the Princess Boulevard off-ramp. I-17 southbound, a collision at Bethany Home. I-17 southbound, another one at McDowell. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the day today with a high of 103. Right now, with relative humidity of 19%, it's 101 degrees at 2:51.
KJZZ is supported by the Phoenix Symphony, presenting a tribute to the brave as Civil War, World War I, and II imagery are projected above the orchestra while performing Shostakovich and Copland live, October 2nd through 4th, phoenixsymphony.org.
It was once considered among the most modern structures in Phoenix. Located in the heart of downtown, today it's a structure restored in part to its heyday. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez takes us on a tour.
On the corner of Central Avenue and Van Buren Street is the Security Building. It was constructed in the 1920s. It was the office building to many powerful movers and shakers of Arizona. Did you know the Security Building had a penthouse on its top floor?
When the building was built, it was the tallest building in Phoenix. And there's a cupola, a light steeple tower up there. And the light could be seen for 30 miles.
Steve Granillo is with the Maricopa County Facilities Management Office.
We can take the stairs if you want.
You lead the way. And we talk as we tour the more than 80-year-old building.
It was built by Dwight B. Hurd. And him and some other wealthy businessmen here in the city of Phoenix formed a syndicate, and they called it the Security Building. And what they did is they gathered up monies among themselves to go after making this building.
Hurd was considered one of the most powerful business leaders in Arizona at the time. He owned a cattle and investment company and also owned the Arizona Republican newspaper. Granillo says the building was home base for the local farming, citrus, and cotton industry. It was also home to other local leaders, all of whom were Hurd's friends.
This actually was a powerhouse. It was a very influential place. It was probably every bit of as important as our Phoenix Convention Center is today now for us.
The building was originally the shape of an L. By the 1930s, an additional wing was added on the southern side. The builder of that extension was a young Del Webb company. By the 1950s, the building was sold to a bank whose president was another Valley well-known businessman, Walter Bimson.
The Valley Bank actually came to own the building, you know, at one point in time. And that's why he basically said, okay, I'm president of Valley Bank. We own this, we own the building. So, you know, I'm going to have my residence there.
So he had a ninth floor added to the security building and had a 4,000-square-foot penthouse built there. It included an outdoor patio with grass and a gazebo.
Basically, this was the Bimson residence here. And as you can see, it had quite a nice view.
It's a clear view of the valley as far as Camelback Mountain. And the outdoor patio has been converted into a viewing area.
Now, if you look over your shoulder, there's the cupola I was telling you about. That's pretty outstanding.
Maricopa County purchased the building in 2001. Much of the building has been restored to its original state. By the way, there has been talk that the Bimson penthouse had a pool in the outdoor area. But Granillo says the county hasn't found any documents that show there was one. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique, send us a note. The show at KJZZ.org.
There are lots of ways to learn a foreign language. For one ASU professor, the method of choice is a musical immersion. Clarice Deal teaches Portuguese and uses that country's best-known music, the bossa nova, to teach her students.
I love music, and I think music can help students to remember verbs, tense, and vocabulary, and also things about the culture.
Do you find that it's the music itself? Is it the words in the music? What is it? I mean, how does it work?
Well, it's like when you are a child and your parents sing music for you and you start to repeat after a while. And it's the same process. You sing and you remember how to build a sentence, how to pronounce the words.
So what kinds of music do you tend to use in your class?
I love bossa nova because it is a mix of jazz and samba, and the lyrics talk about love, sadness, nature, feelings. And it's a swing. The students can sing slowly and learn a lot about how to pronounce the words and also retain the vocabulary.
How do your students react when you flip on music?
Well, when I come to the class every day, they said, are you going to sing today? And say, yes, but first I have to teach you some rules and say, oh, no, we want music, professor.
So am I right that you grew up in Sao Paulo?
Yes, I was born in Sao Paulo, and also I live in Rio for some 10 years.
When you were learning English, did you use music or did your teachers use music to help you learn English?
Yes, my brother was responsible. He was my teacher in high school, and he used to bring Beatles music, Elvis Presley's music for class.
Really?
In class.
So you were learning English by rock and roll.
Yes.
So I mean, you talked about using bossa nova in your class. Is there sort of a Portuguese equivalent of the Beatles or Elvis or someone like that that you would consider using in your class also?
Well, bossa nova, it's better in the way they sing, because Beatles, they sing really fast. And in general, because it's another gender, they sing rock and roll. And bossa nova is a swing, is slow. It's like, can I sing? Olha que coisa mais linda, mais cheia de graça, ela menina que vem que passa. This is the girl from Ipanema. Yeah, it's like a swing. They can feel the words. Olha, qualquer coisa. They can repeat and sing. And some students, of course, don't like to sing in class, but when I play this song, they can follow and they feel so confident because they are speaking Portuguese.
Ah, se ela soubesse que quando ela passa, o mundo sorrindo se enche de graça.
Clarice Deal teaches Portuguese at ASU. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Ah, welcome. Obrigada.
Tall and tan and young and lovely, the girl from Ipanema goes walking, and when she passes, each one she passes goes
And if you're starting your weekend a little bit early, a lot of things to do around the valley tonight at 7 at Akchin Pavilion, Foo Fighters.
You can also check out the store's Objection tomorrow night. That's at Space 55 in Phoenix.
Mark, would you describe yourself as a little bit country or a little bit rock and roll?
Do I have to choose just one?
I would say you're kind of a mix, right?
Yeah, I'd like to think so.
And Donny Osmond is going to be at the Wild Horse Pass Hotel and Casino tonight at 8.
You can also check out the ASU football team. They'll be hosting USC tomorrow night. That's at Sun Devil Stadium in Tempe.
And if in the area of Talking Stick Resort tonight and tomorrow at 8 o'clock, you'll want to see the Thunder from Down Under.
The show is produced by our senior producer, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Anika Klein, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Regina Revozova, and Tiara Vian. Sky Shout and Domenico Nicosia are the digital team. Our managing editor is Tracy Greer, news director Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban. We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know if you have some good story ideas. The show at kjzz.org. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. All Things Considered is next. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. It's 3 o'clock.